Muller House meeting, Saturday afternoon, 24th September 1977. We have tried so far to consider in depth the nature of man and mind in relationship to transcendence, to what we commonly call God, to that primordial creative energy because of which everything is here and now. You must try to feel this out with the brain as quiet as possible, but very alert. If you can't immediately understand, don't let the brain be preoccupied with finding a meaning for it now. Just listen. Man is transcendence thinking. Man, in the transcendental sense, and not merely in the sense of living beings whom we meet and whom we know and so forth. Transcendence thinking. And as we have already seen, transcendence does not think as you and I think. We just have a string of words and thoughts, concepts in our minds. But transcendence thinking is the same as transcendence minding. Mind, the active agent of creation, in transcendental terms, transcendence minding raises up man as the transcendental man form, Purusha Veda, as the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad puts it. It is this original man form that is referred to, not only in the Upanishad, but in that first chapter of Genesis, and Elohim said, minded, Elohim minded, let us make man in our own living image. Now, as we have seen, mind in its reality is not mind merely as we understand it. It is the active agent of the creative process. And we, as expressions of that creative process, if we realize that supreme state of consciousness, which is the state of complete and perfect communion within transcendence, possible to us as human beings, then we talk of it in these terms. Transcendence never talks, doesn't write letters to us, or produce systems of philosophy or books. It's completely beyond us. It is you or I, if we reach, can enter into that supreme communion, can afterwards, when we come back to ordinary consciousness, where the senses and the logical brain are functioning, then we try to talk about it. And we can only present in our human terms that supreme reality of which mankind and man are only a tiny fraction. That is why in the supreme teachings throughout the religions you will find that the highest expression we can give of God or transcendence is as a person, as man. The mind, the thought in the mind of God, as Hellenistic Egyptian teachings put it. You see, so we can't escape this ultimate limitation, born of the fact that we try to present that which is our own supreme realization. So, man is transcendence thinking. And remember that the word thinking here really should be transcendence minding. Now, mind is, in other terms, transcendence meditating. Now, this is very important. Transcendence meditating is mind. And both are empty of anything that we can ever, we here as human beings, can ever realize, quite beyond it all. So whatever we human beings speak or write is a reflection, a shadow, if you like, of that ultimate supreme reality. Please don't feel, what is the use of talking of shadows? If it is beyond us all, why not leave it alone? Yes, you are free to leave it alone. But what is the consequence of man leaving this alone? He is in confusion, he is in sorrow. He is subject to death in his deep awareness. He cannot get beyond mortality. But it is our destiny so to grow that immortality and eternity in our limited manner can be realized whilst we are alive. There is no realization after the death of the organism. transcendence will realize itself through new organisms which it continuously brings into being through the creative process. We are like the leaves of a tree which fall off. If we have played our part in full, then the world in some way or other, in a profound and a deep way, goes forward. Because man, you and I, as human beings, are the link between transcendence and that which is not yet man. So, transcendence meditating is the fundamental meaning of mind in its supreme reality and the meaning of man. I am introducing our topic tonight in this manner because this word meditation is becoming popular. Everybody is rushing about to learn meditation. Now, no one can teach me meditation. See, I've tried to suggest what meditation in its innermost reality is. Transcendence in the process of creation. The whole cosmos is the sign, and all that there is in the cosmos are the innumerable signs of transcendence meditating, of the Spirit of God moving over the face of the waters. Now, unless we have some sort of deep sensitivity about that, we will approach meditation in the wrong way. Always. Especially if we are unfortunate enough through our ignorance to go to people who are self-professed teachers of meditation. Self-professed teachers. They present you, they attract you by promising you some wonderful result, some wonderful goal for the self. The limited self. But this is precisely what meditation is not about. Meditation is for the selfless. It cannot be learned from another. As and when the psyche is wholly pure, one's life is the pure life, living the simple commandments, the simple moralities. When the psyche is quiet and still, and the brain is purely the instrument of observation, then transcendence meditating is able to come through from the transcendent levels of pure mind into our own psychophysical being. In other words, the psyche will now be completely in tune with pure mind, the divine mind. Then we will be naturally in the state of meditation, which is the state of supreme communion possible to man. Supreme communion possible to man. And it goes right beyond the limits of all time and space. Do try and understand this. If we are pure, if we are quiet, if we have released this inner silence, which we have considered up to a point in our meetings, then there are no barriers between transcendence meditating and our own selves. The organism, the body and its senses and the brain and the psyche, our particular mental processes, offer no obstruction to transcendence meditating through you. Get the idea? You get the feel of it. This is real meditation. There is nothing, therefore, for you or me to achieve, nothing to gain, nothing to attain, because in this state of supreme communion, you are totally outside the whole sphere of mortality and worldliness, where gaining or losing, succeeding or failing have meaning. None of our criteria, none of our standards ever reach anywhere near this transcendent realm, which is a unitary whole, a single realm, free of duality, but miraculously expressing itself in terms of both duality and multiplicity. This is what is meant by the glory of God which fills the universe. You will find this sort of thing represented in the Isha Upanishad and of course in the Old and New Testaments and so forth. But who understands these things? It is very difficult to understand. So, there are no rewards, there are no punishments associated with true meditation. If anybody says to you, come to me, I'll teach you meditation, it will make you fit, it will make you healthy, strong, you will be happy and enjoy life and so forth. Enjoy life. You won't be living. You will be dreaming, peculiar dreams. You will be moving through dark solitudes, thinking that this is the land of light. What did Jesus say when he asked for the penny to be brought to him? Unto Caesar, give what is Caesar's, but unto God what is God's. In the realm of Caesar, in which we all function, the dualistic realm, the realm where we are self-centered and self-concerned, wanting to gain something and grow, you see, in the realm of Caesar, there are finite things which you can give. They are mortal. And you end with mortality. But what do you give to God? To transcendence. Your total being. And how can you give your total being, excepting by completely negating the self, the separate self? You completely negate all worldliness, all separate selfness. That is what constitutes our positive action. And if one can negate oneself totally and completely, then there is only transcendence. The waters of the Kaltenbach move into the Isar, and the Isar into the Danube, and the Danube into the ocean. And there is no Danube and no Isar and no Kaltenbach. Only that eternal ocean. What did Jesus say in this connection? In St. John, chapter 8, verses 28 and 29, then Jesus said unto them, when ye have lifted up the Son of Man, then shall ye know that I am He. And the word He, as understood in the deep teachings of the Kabbalah, refers to Yahweh in eternity, in timelessness, spacelessness. There is no world there. That is the meaning of the word He in this context. How has man through the centuries interpreted that sentence? Now, he goes on, that I am He, when ye have lifted up the Son of Man, the Son of Mind, and that I do nothing of myself. He's referring to the manifestation of the Son of Mind in terms of the particular manifestation named Jesus. That I do nothing of myself, but as my Father had taught me, I speak these things. Lifted up the Son of Man. And of course the theologians explain it, I think they do, correct me if I'm mistaken here, the theologians explain it as lifted him up on the cross, the crucifixion. In the profound spiritual sense, that is so. How can you and I understand this? The old teachings represented Yahweh, the eternal, the beyond all description, as in the shape of a man, and also in the shape of a tree. Remember what I said at the beginning in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad? The Purusha Veda in man form. You see? Now, represented in man form, there are 10 aspects presented for that. And that aspect, which is called compassion by us human beings, beauty, justice, harmony, all these which mediate between infinite mercy on the one hand and judgment and punishment on the other hand. This is represented at the level of the heart in the man form. You see? The transcendent itself is there. The actual transcendent no one can touch, no one can ever experience. But when that transcendent shows itself, emanates into certain fundamental archetypal forms of energy, man can touch those. And the one he touches in accord with the origin of the Judaic teaching is that aspect which is called wisdom. Wisdom, Chokhmah, and the father, Abba, the son of the unknown, is the father. Abba, Ba, son. The father of the unknown is associated with Chokhmah, the wisdom. The supreme wisdom, which completely goes beyond anything that you and I can put into language. When the Son of Man is lifted up, means that they are in open communication, in open communion. Because there are these archetypal forms of expression of the creative energy, which are the great channels through which the outpouring from transcendence into all levels of creation can take place, and especially man on this planet, the earth. So, Jesus puts it in these words, or at least the gospel writers who remembered what he taught as best as they could remember. What he taught must have been immensely more profound. Together with that terrific spiritual influence which radiates from a person like Jesus the Christ. Jesus the Christ. The Christ consciousness is associated there, Tifereth. When that is lifted up to the level of Chokhmah, I and the Father are one. The identical teaching which you find in the Upanishads, Pratyagatma and Paramatma are one. It's very interesting, all this. I do nothing of myself but as my Father had taught me. But as my Father had taught me, I speak these things. And he that sent me, this wisdom, this Abba in heaven, is with me. I think in other contexts he says, the Father, yes, believe me, the Father is in me. and I am in the Father. You see, the whole sphere of duality and separation is completely out. And he that sent me is with me. The Father hath not left me alone. Alone here means separated, lonely. In Gethsemane, there is that temporary moving through the valley of the shadow of death. And there is the terrible agony, the dark night of the soul, as the mystics put it. But that is only temporary. The Father hath not left me alone, for I do always those things that please him. How else can a bodily human voice say these things, excepting in the language that bodily human beings understand? So it is put in this form. But it is for us somehow to penetrate into the inner meanings. And then in chapter 12, verse 24, verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone, lonely. Note, the seed falls into the ground and dies. What is this death? Not destruction. Transformation. If it didn't die, how would there be a plant? If the seed said, oh, I want to remain a seed forever and ever. It's a fossil. It's stuck. It has failed of its life's fulfillment and purpose. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. If I am an acorn to start with, and I fall out of the oak tree into the soil, if I want to remain an acorn, that's death in the destructive sense. But if, as an acorn, I die to my acornhood, I grow into the oak tree and bring forth millions of acorns in my life. Now look, we cling to life, we cling to ego, to the perpetuation of this separate egoism. When we say, I am I, what are we saying? The three words, I am I, as said by a psychophysical organism, is a finite mortal thing which will inevitably die. The I am I idea comes into being after the person is born. Do remember that. And it is maintained as an expression of the person's ignorance of reality throughout his life. And this is the thing he will not let go. He's grasping tightly to it. But death comes inevitably. Where is I am I? Where is that mental, that intellectual arbitrary statement, I am I? And it is this I am I which wants to continue in a mythical hereafter. Of course, always in heaven, because I am always a good fellow. You see, we cling to something which we ought not to cling to. And to God, the total self, no persistence of a separate personality which manufactures the idea I am I and ascribes immortality to the I am I. The real immortality is in completely relinquishing the I. Then the corn of wheat bears much fruit, the unknown, the truly immeasurable and rich and wonderful. So we preserve selfness and egoism that way. But see what Jesus himself said. If it die, if this corn of wheat fall into the ground and lets go any sense of I am I, then it will bring forth much fruit. And he says in chapter 12, verses 49 and 50, "For I have not spoken of myself." The word "of" in that context means, I think its real meaning is, I have not spoken as myself, on my separate personal authority speaking to you. Personality is the usurper of the true king. The person, the divine person. That's why people who are big personalities have to preserve their image before the world. Are poor, unfortunate, misguided people. Not personality, but the divine person. The personality has to completely dissolve in order that that divinity may remain divinity, the everlasting transcendent light and creative power. "For I have not spoken as myself, on my own authority, but the Father which sent me, he gave me a commandment what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that his commandment is life everlasting." Life everlasting, which includes the alternation of what we commonly call birth and death, samsara, as they say in the East, in India. "Whatsoever I speak, therefore, even as the Father said unto me, so I speak." It's transcendence speaking through you, the sinless, perfected, Holy One, as the Father speaks through your voice, through the voice of Jesus. Now you see the real beauty and the unspeakable marvel of selflessness. When this is manifest in our lives, we are meditating. It is that state of meditation, the fully realized state, which enables Jesus to say such things. I draw your attention to the New Testament. These things have considerable expounding throughout the Upanishads and other scriptures. You see? But you were born in Europe of a Christian culture, Christian influence, conscious or unconscious, and that is why it may interest you to be presented with this sort of thing. And then he says in chapter 15, verse 15, all things that I have heard of my Father, I have made known unto you. This is where he just speaks to the disciples. Now, does Jesus ask the disciples, come to me, I will teach you meditation, you will become strong and beautiful and healthy and enjoy life? My kingdom is not of this world. Therefore, how do we act? How do we live in order that this state of realization, which is transcendence meditating, may come through to us? As I said earlier, by completely negating worldliness, completely negate all worldliness, do away with it. How? Not by throwing it away. Not by saying, oh, I have no use for this anymore. I want that transcendent world. Well, you will neither get the transcendent world because you want it. You want to gain something. Nor will you have this world anymore. And then you will be a liability on society. And what's more, it will so upset you, it will bring such tribulation and trial that you can sink into a very sad state. One of the saddest is the derangement of the mind, of the psyche, of the brain. This instrument, the brain, may get deranged by the conflict set up in yourself. So remember, no one can teach me meditation. Meditation, the state of meditation, is a natural function of the mind. The mind, the universal mind, which is now entering into you and is fused with your psyche, because the psyche is pure, its natural function is this meditation. When we talk of meditating, of praying to God or the Supreme or whatever it is, what do? We go through a verbal ritual. We push our thoughts into a particular mold, a particular form. And our thoughts are only strings of words, all of which have real meaning only in the context of worldliness, of duality and multiplicity, of what is finite and perishing. And we are so blinded, so darkened by the worldly process, which is what we are acquainted with, that we transpose it and impose it upon the transcendent process. If I have learned harmony and counterpoint and fugue and fugal analysis and orchestration and all the rest of it, but haven't got the divine magic for creating, can I say to myself, I will now write the finest symphonies and quartets and whatnot in the world? What nonsense. Modern science might be able to produce a computer which will turn out a symphony. You see how easily we are misled. I say things which may hurt someone because it upsets people's illusions and delusions. Because it produces inner confusion and makes it even more confounded, more confused. And so there is fear and sorrow inside. But don't be afraid. Don't feel that, if I let go of this, what have I in its place? You don't really need anything in its place. You don't really need it. This is what we have to wake up to. You see, that is why people jump out of one confused situation into another confused situation. Just stay quiet. It will of its own accord change in the living process. Because it is the nature of life to heal itself if I don't interfere with the life process. This is the great point. Now don't think therefore that bodily also, If the body gets ill, I'll do nothing about it. I mustn't interfere with the bodily process when I am ill. Interfering with the process is quite different from doing the right thing. Quite different. If you're sensible, you go to somebody who knows about the functioning of the body and can help you. But if you start interfering with the bodily process, you might kill yourself also. Now the life process of the psyche is a little similar to that. By communicating with your friends, with your dear ones, you can get a certain benefit. But whereas the body is something which can be examined with physical eyes, with physical instruments, because the body consists of different organs and so forth, and can be dealt with as such, the psyche is different. Who can see your psyche? The professional psychologist may be able to understand something of your psyche. But the professional and experimental psychologist has a very, very long way to go. Because there is hardly any, I'm being cautious in saying this, otherwise if I was not cautious I would say outright, there is no professional psychologist or psychiatrist who knows anything about the psychology of the completely healthy, mature mind. He can't deal with it. He doesn't know what health is. He knows what the sick psyche is. And he himself is a sick man. It's notorious how many professional psychologists are sick people themselves, terribly sick people. So, this is your sanctum, your sanctuary, your psyche. It is you alone who are permitted to look into it and who can see the truth of it, the fact of it. And as and when you see the truth of it in your own psyche, see the fact as the fact. That seeing truly is the diagnosis as well as the medicine for the sick psyche. A doctor can hand you a physical medicine which you can take and put into your system. No one can hand you the salvation of the soul. This is the meaning of you and I as individual, indivisible human beings, and our self-responsibility. And beyond that, when you have seen that, comes the profounder meaning of individuality. Awakening in mind, now I'm talking of mind in its deeper and greater sense, you see. Awakening in mind and consciousness to your complete relationship with the totality, the whole cosmos. And if you awaken to it, then you are in the state of supreme communion. Then the divine mind is meditating through you, and you have fulfilled the purpose of your existence. You see? So beware of the self-professed teacher of meditation. In the olden days, there was no self-professed teacher of meditation who said, "Come to me." Even Jesus never said, "Come unto me and I will teach you meditation and how to unite yourself with God." He said, "Come unto me, all who labor, who work, because their aspirations and their heart spontaneously has moved them to the transcendent, and I will give you rest." That does not mean cessation from labor, but peace of mind, because he himself had realized that peace. He himself was the living expression of Yahweh Elohim meditating. Now, can you bear with a little more? Just a few words. I have mentioned these archetypal forms of creative energy. These archetypal forms of creative energy, insofar as perfected holy ones, the true saints, you see, insofar as they have, through their purification, contacted these energies, your sensitivity will grow with your purification. And you will become aware, you will sense this kind of archetypal form of energy and that kind of archetypal form of energy. And man in the past has expressed this awareness of these fundamental archetypal forms, which are universal in their manifestation. They have their particular forms in us, in our own psyche also, you see. These archetypal forms have been named with the names of the archangels, the angels, and so forth. Michael, Michael, he who is like God. That likeness to God is potential within you. You may be the world's worst sinner, the most horrible person, but Michael is a potentiality inside you. Gabriel, the strength and the power of God, the leader of the battalions of God. Battalion is an unfortunate word because it conjures up the picture of battle. The hosts, the Lord God of hosts referred to in the Old Testament. What are these hosts? All these forms of energy. Those energies which are concerned with the production, maintenance and maintenance of the different forms of manifestation in the cosmos, which are the signs of divinity itself, you see. And there are those agencies simultaneously at work which produce what we call and misunderstand with the word death. They are also all there, and they have their names too. And this is the same in all the great religions of the world. In the Brahmanical teachings, in the Gita also, in the Bhagavad Gita, you will find these extraordinary things mentioned. The devas, deva is usually translated as gods or angels or whatever you like, you see. The devas have certain vehicles. Indra is associated, for instance, with the horse, Uccha Ishuravas, you see. Then there are others who are associated with the animal, the peacock. Now, don't associate proud as a peacock with that peacock. The peacock's feathers are the innumerable eyes of the divine. You look at the peacock's feathers. You see? So these are symbolical teachings to try and present a picture of the transcendent. Now, one last word. In order that you may contact these and be sensitive, if you are sensitive and if you are pure to start with, this is where the moralities come in. Without that, don't attempt it. Otherwise, you'll suffer only. You see? Yes. This is where the brain, which is the link between body and psyche, comes in. The brain is the holder of all the synthesized impressions that come through the senses of memory, of experience. And it is the thing that conditions the psychophysical organism in such a way that these transcendent energies cannot be sensitively felt by you. That is why the brain has to be silent and still. This is one of the important reasons, the practical reasons, why one is silent and quiet. And in that divine silence, which includes all sound, you will enter the state of true meditation. Transcendence minding you.